Many of you will recall the wonderful talk by John at the annual lunch in 2018 when he focused on four college boys who had achieved so much in the First World War. Today we follow that theme, and I now ask John to address us on boys who became extraordinary young men in the Second World War. John.
Let's just test the sound system. Can we hear all right? Okay. If it's too loud, please say so. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I've picked four boys. I could have picked from a couple of hundred. I've picked those four because the first two on the left there were directly involved in D-Day, and of course, D-Day was 80 years ago this last June. The two of them were fighter pilots. They flew Hawker Typhoons. Not really a fighter pilot, but we'll talk more about that. The two on the right were bomber pilots. The bomber pilots there in the middle was indirectly involved in the sense that they were hitting targets inland from the beaches to suppress incoming Nazi traffic and so on. And then the one on the right, I'll talk about them. So I just hope to show in the course of this talk how these four little boys actually develop into amazing young men. Several years ago, and in fact over time, as I got to know more about the boys in that particular photograph, 1939, I was struck more and more by the fact that two of them had within 4 years of that won the Military Cross. Now the Military Cross is the second highest award for bravery within the British forces. And for interest, our national chairman, Charles Waghorn, has brought along his own grandfather's Military Cross from the First World War. And in fact, as you will see there, it also has a string of medals to do with the Boer War. As I say, those two there won the Military Cross. Now, the rest of them, of this group of 39 rugby players, six joined the RAF, eight signed up with various army units, and one with the Navy. And yet, as you may remember, there was no conscription in Southern Rhodesia at that time. They were all volunteers. By 1944, two of them had won the Military Cross, as I've said, the second highest award. Four had been killed. Four had been wounded, including one who ended up in a POW camp, having miraculously survived being shot down while trying to torpedo a German battleship in a Norwegian fjord. So what made them sign up? Was it the kind of patriotic favor that affected so many at the start of World War I, when people in this country still referred to Britain as home? Was there also an element of bravado, coupled perhaps with the excitement of going off to fight in far-off places? Quite a few of those who did don uniform, unlike their World War I predecessors, were born in this country. They wouldn't have had the same strong ties to Britain. One contributory factor, I think, was the fact of the very early establishment in this country of the RATG, the Rhodesia Air Training Group. Now, there were training groups by the RAT, let's say, there were air training groups in other countries as well, but ours was the first to get going in May 1940. And I think that perhaps might have influenced quite a few of the youngsters here to head for the Air Force. Whatever the motivation, I hope to illustrate with just a few examples just how many boys from the 1930s went on to become such extraordinary young men by the mid-1940s. But before I do so, I must make something clear. The people that I will focus upon all went to St. George's College. Basil, Wakefield, Richard Wood, my apologies, and others as well, okay? The only reason for that is that as the archivist at St. George's College, I have access to the necessary records and photographs. If other well-known, long-established schools like Prince Edward, Plumtree, Milton, Chaplin, and what was originally Umtali High School have similarly comprehensive archival records, I've absolutely no doubt whatsoever that they would also be able to identify these outstanding young men. And just kind of again trying to mitigate the problem, I've brought along a couple of books there. One is the is a history of Rhodesian schools, part one. And in that history, the various schools like Prince Edward and Chaplin and so on have lists of their war dead. Obviously schools like Peterhouse and Falcon just didn't begin to feature, they hadn't even been thought about. And then there's also the list that's contained in MacDonald's War History. And then I've also brought along Beryl Salt's Pride of Eagles, because in that book there are also then lists of people who won medals. So having made that admission, I must also point out in selecting the four that I have, there are dozens of others from St. George's that I'll not mention, including those two military cross holders. In all, some 430 old Georgians are recorded as having served in World War I, of whom 56 died. There, for interest, is the picture of the military cross. That one was actually won by an old Georgian. It was the first military cross awarded during the Second World War for in the African theatre. It was a major Kio. He had led a raid of Somali irregulars on an Italian camp. And that's him as a little boy there on the left in the St. George's Band in Bulawayo, 1917. If Professor John Lawrence is here, no, he's not. That's his grandfather at the back there. Not his grandfather, rather his father, who was a champion bugler. So I've had to be selective, I hope, and to show in the course of the talk why I've picked these four. On another occasion, if there was sufficient interest, I could probably talk about others. As I've said already, one reason for selecting them is that two of them were involved in D-Day. And then the third of them was a direct contemporary of the first two, and we'll pick up on that. So the first of them was a chap, there's the St. George's Chapel, by the way, and it has, in a side chapel, it has tablets to the First World War and Second World War dead in old Georgian. Then on either side of that, there are brass plaques listing the names of those old Georgians who were killed during the Bush War. So, the first of them, Porig Culligan. He was called Paddy by his flying colleagues later, but his real name, his given name is Porig, Patrick, the Irish for Patrick. He was a college boarder from 36. In fact, he was there. Those pictures are left and right, 36, 37, or thereabouts. Porig Connolly was born in India in February 1924. He really only came to my attention in 2017 when, out of the blue, his niece in Johannesburg, who had been referred to me by John Reed Rowland, emailed to ask whether we had any information in the college archives about her late father, Dennis Culligan, as well as his younger brother, this chap. All she really knew about them in the context of St. George's was that Dennis, having been at St. Aidan's College in Grahamstown, which was another Jesuit college, had finished his schooling up here, but she knew virtually nothing about his time here and very little about this lad. The father hardly spoke about him. So she was thrilled when I was able to tell her that her father was not only one of the leading academics in his matric year, that's him on the left, but that he'd also played first team cricket. He also joined up at the beginning of the war in South Africa and as a member of the Transvaal Irish Regiment was captured in North Africa and spent his life as a POW, or rather spent his war career as a POW. Porig, on the other hand, wasn't an academic, wasn't really a great sportsman, or at least put it this way, he wasn't on the face of it an academic, and an average was. While a number of photographs show him to have been a typical and gregarious schoolboy, his student card told otherwise. You won't be able to see it from here, but at the bottom of the card there, from 1935 to 41, there are a series of comments by his teachers over the years. And the teachers back then weren't given to political correctness or whatever you'd like to call it. Included among the comments recorded on his card were phrases like lazy, dirty, careless, disgraceful, irresponsible, constantly distracted by bewitching trifles, A noisy buffoon, Overshaw lacks concentration. And then once or twice interspersed with comments like, quite fair on the whole, good, but doesn't work consistently. He sounds like your average Rhodesian schoolboy. So there he is. He's a scout in 1935. He's sitting in the middle there at the back of the college bite hall. Others in that group, there's your military cross holder, one of them. Chap on the left, the seated on the ground, is a chap called Mark Partridge. Mark Partridge later became a cabinet minister here, Minister of Local Government. There on the right is Pori Culligan playing for a house cricket team, and on his right again, or rather on his left, holding the cricket ball, is a chap called Merrick Heath, and we'll come to him. And there behind is Mark Partridge again. So, as I say, your average schoolboy, there's Pori Culligan in the front, and there's this chap, Merrick Heath, that I'll come to. So clearly, gregarious, got on with his friends, but probably also a bit of a scallywag. I'll come back to this man just now. According to the written reminiscences of a contemporary student of theirs that we have in the archives, these are reminiscences by a chap who was at the college, Porrick's nickname at St. George's was Bangers, given his apparent predilection for sausages. And he was also a member of a particular gang within the school in the very late 1930s, referred to by the rector of the day as the Rough Gang. Its leader was a boy called Angus Samuels, and he appears to have been quite a character. In those days, discipline in the schools was tough, and corporal punishment was very much a part of the daily routine. Samuels, having broken some rule, probably smoking, was ordered six cuts, by the rector, Father Ben Weaver. And that is Ben Weaver, highly respected by the boys, a man's man of note, coached rugby and boxing, tended to prefer a motorbike to a car, and as I say, quite a tough character. Anyway, Samuels neglected to get these cuts to the extent that the number accumulated and his punishment totaled up to something like 6 cuts a day for 6 days. Quoting from the same set of reminiscences, the rector was said to have been something of an artist with a cane and would ask his hapless victims, left hand or right, backhand or forehand. But he was ambidextrous, and the boys knew this. It made little difference to the precision with which he could lay one stripe on top of another. When the time of retribution came, a small crowd gathered each day at morning break, and Doug McClymont will remember this from our school days, probably Willie Turner. A small crowd would gather outside to watch. At morning break, Angus Samuels would arrive smiling, and he would emerge from the rector's office also still smiling, and he'd walk nonchalantly down the steps, showing no sign whatsoever of the agonies that his increasingly empurpled buttocks must have given him. It was said to be an unforgettable performance. So there is Angus Samuels as a youngster. That's him in 1935, having shot half of the wildlife in the country, together with his older brother, James Samuels. James Samuels joined up at the beginning of the war, was in the Devonshire Regiment, was commissioned, and he was at the retreat of Dunkirk. James Samuels then joined Churchill's cutthroats in the Mediterranean and was wounded in Crete. So there's Angus Samuels as a young boy. I don't have a photograph of him as an adult. Anyway, after leaving school in December 39, Angus Samuels joined up, and after undergoing training in Bulawayo, went on to be commissioned into the Indian Army before then joining the Gurkha Rifles. There he too earned a military cross, and it was given in the field, or rather awarded in the field, against the Japanese in Burma before returning to Europe and sadly losing his life fighting in Crete in December 44. He was mentioned in dispatches. In Porrick's time at St. George's, well over half the pupils were boarders, and they were allowed over weekends when not involved in sport to wander off into what are now the botanical gardens to the north and west of the school. It was referred to as park leave. And there's an illustration, not of Samuels' group, but of another 1941 group. That group, they were all boarders from Malawi, and I guess they would have hung together. So they were allowed to go off into the botanical gardens. They weren't the gardens then. And there they were able to brew up their tea, cook all sorts of strange dishes, and probably smoke their illicit cigarettes. In the case of the Rough Gang, they also constructed a treehouse and they kept their food supplies in an ammunition box they'd scrounged from the armory and buried near the tennis courts. Led by Samuels, the gang would also go on raids at night beyond the park's boundaries, resulting in, and again I quote from this reminiscence, resulting in the more or less wholesale theft of fruit from the orchards of Salisbury's outlying suburbs. That will give you, there's St. George's from the air in 1936, roughly. So there is what is now Grand Gun Hill. There's the Borrowdale Road going out through the trees there. We are seated somewhere there in amongst those gum trees. So it was a school in the country. So they must have raided towards town, maybe into the avenues, maybe around into Eastleigh. Because there's another picture. So there are the botanical gardens, so-called. There's Alexandra Park and there's the Borrowdale Road. That one shows the school looking towards Avondale Ridge, Avondale, and so on. So again, it was a school in the country. For them to go raiding like that, they must have had to travel quite far. I'll come back to that. During one of these raids on an orchard, the irate householder was disturbed and came roaring into his garden. One of the gang dropped some piece of evidence, and a few days later, the angry man was brought into the school study place in a hopeless attempt to identify the raider. It was nevertheless an episode of high tension among the guilty. As already mentioned, Porrig was a direct contemporary of the other two people, or two of the others that I shall mention, John Lunan Sloss on the right, and Mary Keith on the left. They all left St. George's at the end of 1941, and all would appear to have joined the RATG at the same time. Although I don't have photographs of all three in the same group together at school, they certainly all visited the school together just before they were posted overseas, as is shown by an entry in the school visitors book, the 2nd of May, 1943. So there at the top is Mary Keith's signature. There's Culligan, there's Loon and Sloss, there's a chap called Dell, there's Mark Partridge. That's Dickie Bradshaw, who later became Air Commodore in this country in the Rhodesian Air Force. Porrig was aged just 19 at the time, and the other two were just 20, but I'm getting ahead of myself just a little. According to a register of old Georgians who joined up both the First and Second World Wars, and that register is up here if anybody wants to look at it, Porrig signed up in Bulawayo in March 1942 and then was posted initially to the RATG in Belvedere in September before moving on to Cranbourne Flying School in and earning his wings in the following February 1943. He earned them at the same time as Lunan Sloss. So, and these pictures, I hope, will show his progress having joined up to that of becoming a pilot. So you've got the raw lad on the left there with his father. You've got him as the trainee pilot, early 42. There he is, probably doing basic training at Heaney. He's got one stripe in his sleeve. There he's got three stripes on his sleeve. I'm not sure whether he's got his wings at that stage. That's the passing out group in 1943. So Porrig is standing back row there and Lunan Sloss is there. To try and bring the picture closer, there he is again, and there's Lunan Sloss. That's him having just got his wings in this country. So he's got the RATG badge on. There he is, I guess, still in this country, and there he is as the suave pilot in Britain that he became. Remember, he's probably only still 19 at that stage. At some point after their arrival in the UK, both Porrig and Lunan Sloss were posted to 266 Rhodesia Squadron, which by that time was re-equipped with Hawker Typhoons. Sorry, just again, there's him probably still in training in Britain, learning to fly a Spitfire, and there he is at a later date, leaning nonchalantly against his Typhoon and probably going on a mission. We don't have time now to go into the details of the squadron, but it comprised many Rhodesians, and its badge included the Indibele word. That's him again. Clearly now with a squadron, but standing fairly diffidently at the back as a young 19-year-old. There's the badge for the 266 squadron. Klabba Zulu apparently means stabbers in the sky. And as we'll talk about briefly, that squadron were dive bombers. Those are just a few of the pilots who were in the squadron, probably when they were still flying Spitfires. I do have the names of some of them. None of those were old Georgians. Earlier in the war, that Rhodesia squadron were classified as a fighter squadron flying Spitfires, but following the development of the Hawker Typhoon, it was repurposed, the squadron that is, as a ground attack squadron. Apparently when the Typhoon was first developed, and there's the Spitfire on the left and there's the Typhoon on the right, when it was first developed with a bigger, more powerful engine than that of the earlier Spitfires, it was hoped that it would be fast enough to outpace the German Focke-Wulf 190s, and so it was, but apparently only at altitudes below 8,000 feet. Above that, its thicker wings, and it had much, much thicker wings than that, and a much bigger engine. Its thicker wings created too much drag, whereas its great speed at low altitude, its heavy armament of 420 millimeter cannons and two 1,000-pound bombs, and later on, also its ability to carry rockets, made it a very powerful weapon at low level. So there's another picture of a Typhoon being loaded up. That one still doesn't have the rocket launchers underneath, but there are bombs being loaded. Another photograph, now this time showing someone scrambling to a Typhoon, and that one does have the rockets. And here's one of Porig's colleagues, somebody that I only know by the name of Ellis, displaying the warhead on those rockets. And there's an armorer, obviously, on his way to loading a whole bunch of them. At this point in my talk, and given that Porig and John Loon and Schloss were now members of the same squadron, I'm going to look jointly but briefly at their ongoing careers. Before I do that, however, I'd like to step aside a little and pick up on John Loon and Schloss's background. Just a year older than Porig, he entered St. George's from a convent in January 1933, aged just 10. And there he is, a typical schoolboy, socks down. I don't honestly know who those people are, but judging by the way they're so close to him, I would imagine that at least some of them were his direct siblings. It must be said also that he enjoyed a more successful career at school than did Porig Culligan. Looking at his report card, same thing, remarks down at the bottom there, except that those remarks were a lot more positive. Remarks like, very capable, good all round, shows interest in all departments. He was also a good sportsman. Despite his diminutive stature, he was not only an academic, there he is in the matric class of 1940, but he was also that same team of 1939 that I started with, there he is sitting in front. Okay, and next to him, and I'll come to him later, is a chap called John Barrington. There he is as a cricket player, playing first team cricket, seated on the right, and there he is in the middle. Sorry, there is John, there is Merrick Heath. Just as an aside, that fellow there was named Russell Watson. Russell Watson also earned a military cross in Italy. Apparently, he preferred to carry the Thompson machine gun. And because of that, he was nicknamed by his troopies as Al Capone. Okay, and next to him, again, is this man, Barrington. Loon and Schloss again. Loon and Schloss, obviously very proud of his wings, sends a photograph to the college with his little dedication on it, the 4th of May. Okay, so there he is there, behind him is Barrington, and to the right there is Merrick Heath. As far as I can gather, John Loon and Schloss was a day scholar, so he wasn't likely to be distracted or led astray as a member of one of the school gangs. Interestingly, having passed his school certificate with 3 credits in 1940, he returned to the college in 1941 for a year, during which he studied aircraft construction. It has to be said the Jesuits were pretty versatile in their curriculum. So, moving on. From as early as May 1944, 266 Squadron was one of several Typhoon squadrons based at a place on the Channel coast near to Southampton. So there's the Isle of Wight, and there, given that little diagram there, there is an airfield that was called Needs Oar Point, okay, and it gave them ready access to the channel. There's a photograph of Sir Godfrey Huggins, Prime Minister, and Huggins, of course, had a lot to do with setting up the RATG. So there's Huggins on a visit to the 266 Squadron at that place, Needs Oar. Needs Oar Point was basically farmland, and it was very quickly cleared off, and there were several other Typhoon squadrons operating from there. The fact that Porrick Culligan was in the unit by this time is proven by the fact that in the captions, and that's a page from a photograph album of his that came my way. So there's a photograph, and that photograph is labeled a chap having a bath, obviously under primitive conditions at Needs Oar Point. The other three photographs are taken at a forward airfield just on the other side of the channel in Normandy. But it proves the point that he was already a member of the squadron. So from Needs Oar Point, in the run-up to the invasion, the Typhoons were better able to hit the V1 launch site, the so-called Doodlebug. Those V1s had recently come into commission, and there were launch sites all along the coastline aimed at London. And so that was one of their prime targets. They were also attacking road and rail communications on an increasing basis. These were difficult targets. They were usually dive-bombed, thus exposing the pilots to a greater risk from the German anti-aircraft guns. On D-Day itself, 266 Squadron was over the beaches early in the morning. So there they are, they're flying from Needs Oar Point here, and there are the beaches in Normandy. So from early on the actual invasion day itself, they were flying in support of the landings on the beach. They were flying what they called cab rank patrols, so as to be on call to support the army units below. They were also attacking gun sites and strong points along the cliff, and they were flying recces inland. That's an artist's impression of Typhoons over the beaches. You can see again, they have the cannons, they have the bombs, they don't yet have the rockets. Those came very shortly after that. But interestingly, they were all marked with these stripes so that their own troops on the ground would know who was above and not fire on them, okay? Over the next days and weeks, as the Allied ground forces fought to break out from the beaches and then to advance inland, 266 Squadron and other Typhoon units flew intensively, both in support of and in order to hinder the German reinforcements. From the squadron's operational records books, which are in the Public Record Office in London, it would appear that although Porrig was on the squadron, we know that from the earlier photograph, he didn't actually fly his first operational mission until the 27th of June. And then that was against a target in Rouen, which is close to the beaches. John Lunen Sloss, on the other hand, not only flew operationally, but he was also acting as an interpreter. Apparently, he spoke some German, perhaps because of his Norwegian origin. Quite why he got to fly operationally before Porrig is unknown, but bear in mind that he was almost a year older at the tender age of 20. On the 20th of July 1944, with the Allied forces having pushed further inland from the beaches, the squadron relocated to an airfield called B3 Saint-Croix-sur-Mer in Normandy, while all the time continuing with their ground attacks. There is a photograph now of a Typhoon actually being loaded up with rockets. So in addition to the millimeter cannons and the bombs, they carried these rockets. Apparently the rockets weren't that accurate. It was very much a question of point your plane and shoot, but they made such a racket that apparently quite often tank crews, German tank crews, and also people driving trucks and so on, literally just bailed out rather than be caught. So there was a huge scare factor, but they still had to be flown at low level. On one particular operation, they were bounced. Because they're flying at low level, they were bounced by 25 German BF-109s, and three Typhoons were shot down. That map won't be that visible to you, but basically it's a breakout map. So they're having landed at the beaches of Normandy here, they then began to push inland. And 266 Squadron followed the British Second Army, so they're beginning to go up through the northeast of France towards Lille, and then into Belgium, and subsequently onto Antwerp, and then onto Germany. From this point on, through the months of August, September, October, they continued to fly from a succession of forward airfields where the conditions were primitive and the dirt caused many problems with the aircraft engines. As a particularly harsh winter set in, the conditions on these forward airfields worsened. But by the end of September, they had reached Antwerp, where for a short while, they were able to be billeted in fairly decent conditions. So there is a picture of Porik. He's the third from the, or second from the right, with three of his colleagues. One of the problems with his album is that he quite often just uses a nickname. So on the left is a chap called Ding Dodd. The next one is Shep. I don't know who Shep is. And on the right is somebody called Green. For some reason, he was Pithy Green. But there again is this 19-year-old settling into the unit, having 4 months, sorry, 4 years before that, been raiding houses around Salisbury. There he is, and as I said, the conditions, the snow conditions got worse, and for quite a while, the squadron and other squadrons were limited in what they could do. So there's Porig on the left with a snowball in his hand, probably the first snow he'd ever seen, almost certainly. There is John Luden-Sloss on the right, and then I do have some of the names of some of the other people around them. And I'm jumping ahead just a little. From this point on, with the British and Canadian troops beginning their advance on the Rhine, the squadron was once again mounting cab rank patrols in support of the advance. With the squadron now operating from an airfield called Mill B889 near the small Dutch town of Grave, they were quite close to the German border, and its pilots, both Porig and John, were flying every day. As they advanced into Belgium and again into Holland, they were greeted euphorically by the local people. And there's just a picture, Porig and two of his colleagues with two little Dutch girls. Okay, I'm not sure why the one on the left has got her arm tucked into her sleeve, perhaps in sympathy with the little one here who does appear to have a sling. But there's young Porig Colligan with a couple of the local people. You won't be able to see the details, but there is a page from an operational record book. It's the early in February, and it shows which pilots were flying which number aircraft. These were all Typhoons in the squadron on which days and against which targets. And I do have copies of some of those on the stage if anybody wanted to have a look. It gives the names of the pilots, and it shows the frequency with which they were flying. By this time, John Luden-Sloss had been promoted to pilot officer, but it was here at this Mill airfield, and that is the Mill airfield. Again, it's a forward airfield. It was basically carved out of bush. They moved the Dutch people away and who had houses in the area. They lived in Nissen huts, and the airfields were basically metal sheets laid on the mud. So, as I said, Luden-Sloss had been promoted, but it was here at Mill Airfield on the 26th of March, just 6 days before the German surrender, that Porig Culligan's Typhoon burst a tire on takeoff, going on a sortie. The plane immediately cartwheeled, and he was killed instantly. He was just 21 years old. His commanding officer, squadron leader Sheward, in a letter to his parents drafted on the 29th, that's 3 days later, and I do have a copy of that letter here, wrote, "We loved young Paddy for his happy, laughing spirit, his splendid courage, and the wonderful friend he was to every one of us. As a pilot, he was all that could be desired and could be trusted whatever the occasion. He was up for a commission, which should come through any day now. And I was looking forward to the grand job I knew he would make as a leader." And then towards the end, he goes on, "We buried Paddy today with full military honors and laid him to rest in a picturesque little village called Grave, G-R-A-V-E, in Holland, overlooking the River Maas. Every pilot of this squadron attended his funeral, as well as the wing commander, and as many of the ground staff that could be spared from their work. Every man wanted to attend, but that was not possible. His name, sir," that's to Porig's father, "has brought great honor to this squadron and his memory will remain with us always. So there is the letter. As I say, I've got a copy on the table there. And that's a photograph from his album, must have been added in later, of his coffin being carried out of the airfield to be placed on a truck. And there on the right-hand side are his fellow officers lined up. There is the coffin arriving at the municipal graveyard. Again, his fellow officers on the right, or his fellow pilot, I should say. They weren't all officers. And then you had ground crew on the left forming a guard of honor, led by the chaplain and the wing commander into the graveyard. There's another photo. So there's the chaplain, there's the wing commander, and there are the pilots following directly behind the coffin. There is the chaplain praying over the grave. On the right-hand side, ground crew. On the left-hand side, a gun salute party, and there are his fellow pilots. Heads bowed while the coffin is lowered into the grave. And then a gun salute. Okay. There are his fellow pilots, and there are the ground crew. In the background there, you can see obviously some of the locals. And there, while the last post is being played by a single bugler, there again are his fellow pilots saluting him. His grave is now marked by a Commonwealth War Grave headstone. In fact, he's one of three in that little cemetery in Grave. His grave is in the middle. I'll come back to that just now. Quite remarkably, in addition to that gravestone, there's a group of people living in that part of Netherlands who have embarked on a project to learn as much as they can about the Allied servicemen who lost their lives and what they see as the liberation of their land from Nazi tyranny. As a way of thanking each of them for their sacrifice, this group has established a website, and I do have details of that, under the banner The Overloon War Chronicles. That foundation have set up a museum, and that album from which the photographs have been taken is now in that museum. Established initially in 2020, the stated objective of the foundation is to retrieve photographs and stories of all 281 British servicemen buried in various CWGC cemeteries in that part of southeast Holland, including Grave, where there are these three. Pori Culligan is among them. There's also a detailed write-up about him on this website. So you can dial into the website, you can pick up on him. And information about him at school at St. George's has come from us and also the family album. On Christmas Day last year, that same foundation arranged for the last post to be played over the three graves. And there is an officer saluting. And that, by the way, is the website. I've got a detail of that there if anyone wanted it. Pilot Officer John Lunan Sloss must have been especially upset at Porig's loss, given their common origins and their long association. But he continued flying in daily sorties until peace in Europe was declared on the 8th of May. Judging by photographs of him in the Culligan album, he became one of the squadron's core members. So there he is on the left there. That's actually in the Strand, probably early 1944, before they then went off to the invasion. There he is at a forward airfield on the right, obviously chatting with a fellow sergeant pilot. Looks as though they may even be sitting on a bomb. Moving on again, that is a photograph clearly taken at a forward airstrip, because you can see below them the kind of metal airstrip that was laid out, and there is John Lunenstloss in amongst the other pilots. That there is a group, I'd imagine, of the whole squadron, probably taken after Porig's death. There again is Lunenstloss, clearly now very much a core member of the squadron. The chap at the back there, I'll just point to him and come to him in a moment. So before moving on to the third, getting back to John Lunenstloss, unfortunately, we have no idea what's become of him. Okay? He's disappeared from our records. We know that's the last we know of him. Other than that, this group in Holland found that picture of him as a 10-year-old with his family. So I'm hoping that through today's internet links and all the rest of it, we'll find out where he went to, what became of him. Moving on, as I've said, and I'm going to be talking about the third of our extraordinary young men just now, but I just want to reinforce the point that my talk is about these four because I don't know enough about the others. But there in the same album is a photograph of somebody, Kanni Kannison, one of the pilots. There's Kanni Kannison, obviously looking at a photograph of his wife. These must have all been taken while they were on active service. This is a chap called Doug Borland. He had a twin brother. The twin brother sadly was killed on the 23rd of April. Their names occur on those flight schedules. And then on the right, there's this chap, Ellis. Moving on, there's a chap called Hugh Balance. Hugh Balance is Gary Balance's grandfather. Some of you will know Gary Balance, played cricket for Peterhouse, then went on to play for Yorkshire and play for England until he got shafted by fellow Yorkshire players. His grandfather must have been turning in the grave given his contribution to England and what happened to his grandson. Anyway, Hugh Balance, a chap called Ken Baker, he apparently later flew for Agricare, flew crop sprayers. A chap called Zombie Lang, somebody called Snowy Harrison. I don't know who they are, and I'm hoping that people here, the names might ring a bell, the people here might have a connection. I'm also hoping that people here might have albums, such as the Culligan family had, which will perhaps lead to other people. Also in the album was a photograph of the armourers and someone that I was able to identify, a chap called Paul Nicol. I looked at that photograph and I thought, hang on, that's Spike. His son went to St. George's, his son is still around, and I said to him, is that your dad? He said, yes. Okay. Paul Nicol, when he left school, wanted to become a Jesuit priest, so he went off to England, he joined the Jesuits, and he spent 6 years in England training to be a Jesuit. He was a Jesuit scholastic, in other words, a Jesuit in training, and then decided that actually he didn't have enough of a vocation. So he left the order, married a Welsh lass, and then in about 1957, after the war, after he was demobbed from 266 Squadron and presumably taught in England, he came out to St. George's. He always wore his regimental blazer, or a regimental blazer, very proud of it. And as you can see there, he was also involved with the school cadets, and he had a full array of medals. Okay? But an amazing connection that this chap who was on the airfield with Pory Culligan and would have known Culligan because of the common background, the St. Aidan school days and so on. Amazing that he should have pitched up like that. So, moving on, Mary Keith. Now, these are the same photographs, excuse me, but there's Mary Keith in the middle with a cricket ball, and there he is on the left there. Clearly a very gregarious chap. He was born in 1923. He moved from Plumtree to St. George's in mid-1939, and he can be seen in several of the same photographs as I've just shown. Judging by comments on his student card, and I'm not going to spend time now, but he had a similar student card. He was also quite solid in the classroom, and apparently a little bit headstrong. So there are photographs of him. There's a photograph of him as a member of the college cricket team playing Amtari School, 1941. So there is Heath, there's Loon and Sloss, and there's that chap Barrington. And then other college boys and also Amtali boys. When he left school in 1941 to join the RAF, a remark was made on his student card that if he had returned in 1942, he was sure to be made head boy. Once in the RATG, and there again is your Flight Sergeant Wings photograph, and there he is as a boxer for the RATG. After being awarded his wings in February 1943, unlike the first two, he became a bomber pilot after being shipped to England in May 1943, and at some point was posted to the RAF's number 44 Rhodesia Bomber Squadron flying Lancasters. So there is the 44 Squadron the emblem, and there obviously is a Lancaster bomber. Obviously a quite different aircraft, probably requiring quite different skill sets, almost certainly. He flew his first mission July 1944 as a flight sergeant, and then judging by a photograph and an accompanying article in the Sunday Mail of the 14th of January 1945, he went on to fly 31 missions. Now, he must have flown more after that because the war didn't end for another 3 months. But that was a photograph that was in the Sunday Mail in 1945. And there, so there's the bombs depicting the number of sorties flown, and there is this emblem. Apparently, the diagram depicts the finger of fate, and according to the same article, this was to symbolize the well-known RAF saying, I take their word for it, meaning keep your finger out. In February 1945, the now flight Lieutenant Heath was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. It was awarded for an act or acts of valor or devotion to duty whilst flying on active operations against the enemy. Judging by the photographs of him there on either side, and these also come from the Culligan album, he and Lunan Schloss and Culligan all kept in touch into the war. When Merrick Heath was demobbed in 1945, he joined the BOAC as a commercial pilot, but he must have remained on their RAF volunteer reserve, because with the Berlin blockade commencing 3 years later, he went back into the RAF to fly Avro Lancastrian air tankers. These were basically flying petrol Bowsers. As I'm sure some of you will know, since the fall of Hitler in April 45, West Berlin had been administered by a joint Allied Central Commission. But by early 1948, Joseph Stalin, the Russian leader, had determined to end the arrangement by forcing his former allies, America, Britain, France, to withdraw from the western side of Berlin. So beginning in June 1948, Stalin's forces imposed a total blockade on West Berlin's land access routes, resulting in the cutting off of all food, fuel, medicine, and power supplies to over 2 million people. To counteract the blockade, over the next 11 months, the Western Allies organized an airlift that saw aircraft landing at 3 minute intervals throughout the day and night. These were flying into Berlin in droves, as it were, landing and delivering essential supplies. So just to kind of orientate you, there's Denmark, there's the Baltic Sea, there's West Germany, that's obviously before the unification, there's East Germany, and there's Berlin. Remember, the Russians had overrun the whole of Berlin and had gone well beyond it, but according to agreements made at Yalta and Potsdam and other places, West Berlin was still governed by this commission. Stalin tried to starve them out by blocking the land routes, and they then started flying these air routes into air bases in the center of Berlin. This operation continued day and night through all kinds of weather, but very sadly, on the 22nd of November 1948, Merrick Heath's air tanker crashed into trees on top of a hill after taking off from an airfield in England in thick fog. He and his 7-man crew were killed, and their names, together with those of 79 other Allied airmen, are forever commemorated on a special memorial that's located on the site of what was Tempelhof Aerodrome in Berlin. So there is the actual monument itself, and then around the base of it, as shown there, there are the names of some 79 Allied airmen, American, British, French, and obviously in this case, a Rhodesian. Yes, sorry, whoops, my apologies. That's a close-up of one side of it, and just you can just about make out Captain R.M.W. Heath and then his other fellow pilots. The last of the extraordinary men that I'm going to talk about, Terence Finn, was born in February 1917 and so was some 6 or 7 years older than the other three. The son of a district commissioner, in fact back then he was a native commissioner, but I've gone for the politically correct term, the son of a district commissioner in the Kadoma area, he started at St. George's in 1928 at the age of nearly 11. And as he moved through the school, he developed into an all-round and popular pupil. So there he is as a member of the rugby team in 1933, and on the right, a member, he was a school prefect in 1932, and the following year went on to become deputy head boy. He was also, as I've said, in fact, he had colours for rugby, boxing, and athletics. So there he is as an athlete. And as some here will remember, his son, certainly both of the two of his sons, were very good sportsmen. He also earned colours for, sorry, he was also a strong Catholic. And like Paul Nicol, and I've just mentioned Paul Nicol, when he left school, he went overseas, joined the Jesuits, wanted to become a priest. And apparently he and Paul Nicol actually studied together as Jesuit scholastics. However, after 6 years of training, he too decided that he didn't have sufficient of a vocation to become ordained, and he left the Jesuits. By then, the so-called phony war had started, and so I'm told, he was initially inclined to think along pacifist lines. That is, until the London Blitz started. He then signed up with the RAF in England, and after undergoing flying training in England, this followed a spell as an instructor in Canada. Then he was posted to number 44 Rhodesia Squadron as a Lancaster pilot. And there he is on the left, obviously, as a pilot, pilot officer, and with his first crew on the right. Once in the squadron, he quickly came to be respected both for his cheerful qualities, I guess for his slightly more mature years, and also his unflinching courage. It was in that regard that he was approached in March 1944 by another old Georgian pilot who had just been posted to the squadron with a request that he, this new pilot, be allowed to fly as Terence's co-pilot on a bombing mission. Aged just 20, that pilot was a man called John, or a lad called John Barrington. Sorry, that's Terry Finn with his second crew. Okay, so there he is again in the middle, and the crew, the standard crew for Lancaster at that time was 7. Barrington was keen to get combat experience before taking charge of his own plane and crew. That crew, however, when Barrington said, "Can I fly with you?" were very unhappy. They said it would bring the crew bad luck. Terry Finn said, "Don't be silly. We're just off on a mission." Like the first of the three young men that I've already mentioned, Barrington was class of 41, and by all accounts, one of its most accomplished in all departments. He was a champion diver, swimmer. He went on to represent all of the first teams for several years running. There he is as a diver in 1935. And by the way, three of the others all joined the RAF. Those two as fighter pilots. He won the DFC, and he was sadly killed in the North African desert in a sandstorm. Barrington, again, the diver on the top board there, Barrington, the boxer at the back there, and Barrington in that same team photo that I started with, the little chap on the right, there is John Lunan Sloss. There he is as cadet officer under the pith helmet, and there he is as deputy head boy. So, accompanied by Barrington as co-pilot, Terry and his crew, that's Terry Finn, took off on their 18th mission. And there's a photograph of Terry Finn, a colour photograph of Terry Finn in the hatch there with his crew. Okay, and there inset is a photograph of John Barrington. Unfortunately, that raid involving various other Lancaster squadrons, including Pathfinder squadrons, Pathfinders were those that went ahead dropping flares so as to mark the targets. Pathfinder squadrons, that raid proved chaotic. They were coming in from various different airfields, coming in at different heights. It was chaotic. And one of Terry's fellow pilots reported afterwards that the aircraft concentration over the target was extremely tight, and he had spent all his time avoiding other aircraft over the target. As Terry was leaving the target, having dropped his bombs, his Lancaster suddenly shuddered, the result of a direct hit from below, either from flak, in other words, German anti-aircraft fire, a German night fighter, or possibly a collision with another Lancaster. The impact severed the controls and immediately his plane started plummeting down, gyrating violently and then breaking up. Miraculously, he was thrown clear, initially unconscious, and then, as he later described it, he found himself falling through the air that smelled so fresh after the fume smell of his own aircraft. He then grabbed desperately at his parachute and floated down to land, relaxed on a snow bank. After being taken prisoner, Terry was kept in solitary confinement for 2 weeks while the Germans tried to find out from him why there were two extra bodies in the wreckage of his plane. At that time, Allied aircraft were also flying in people to help with the resistance. There was some suspicion that he had extra people on board. At the time, he, that's Terry, had no idea that his Lancaster had in fact collided on its way down with another plane, and that in the process, the bodies of crew from the second aircraft had become mixed with his own. Within the last year, the niece of one of Terry's own crew members, in fact, the niece of this man sitting in the front there, a woman called Liz Moran, after years of dedicated research, has self-published a book entitled The Raid on Stuttgart, in memory of 15 men over Stuttgart, Germany, 15th of March, 1944. There's a diagram that she put together, and basically what it's doing, it's showing how two separate aircraft collided. One of them then went on to land, they then crashed in different places near Stuttgart, and Terry Finn was the sole survivor. Those other pilots killed, I understand, I've not seen them, are also covered by Commonwealth war graves in Germany. You must remember at that time that the German population, particularly the SS, hated bomber pilots. And sometimes bomber pilots, when captured, were killed by the SS or by badly beaten up by locals. That didn't happen to him, but as I said, he was kept in solitary confinement. As I've said, he spent the rest of the war as a POW, first in Stalag Luft 1 and then Stalag Luft 3, before being liberated by the advancing Allies. However, at the time that his plane went down, his squadron had no idea what had become of him, and a letter was sent to his parents back in Rhodesia, dated the 16th of March, which began, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Finn, please accept my very sincerest sympathy over the anxiety I know you must be feeling. You will have received a telegram telling you that your son is missing as a result of operations last night. The target was Stuttgart." And then, after a couple of more details, he goes on, "Terry's promotion to flight lieutenant had just come through, but unfortunately, just too late for him to know. I can assure you that your son was very much respected in the squadron, both for his cheerful qualities and his unflinching courage. This was his 18th trip over enemy territory. He is a very great loss to the squadron. You will be hearing from the CO, and then also, I thought rather carelessly, also from the Committee of Adjustment, who will be dealing with your son's effects." In other words, packing up what was left in his room and sending it to the family. "Then as a PS to the letter, I have posted to you today a letter from Terry, which Terry had left with me as a request for it to be sent should he not return. In that letter, and it's a long one we don't have time for now, he begins, 'My dear Mum and Dad, I'm writing this letter so that if ever I should be listed as missing, it will not be without having said goodbye. This letter will be posted to you.'" And then he goes on to talk about how he hasn't seen the family for 10 years and how he would love to be home and all the rest of it. He says, he finishes off, "You will not be unhappy or worry about me, I hope. Please pray and trust in God, as we have done for a long while and must continue. God bless you, Mum and Dad, and until we meet again, pray for your living and grateful son, Terence." So, there, sorry, by the way, that's a photo of the front page of Liz Moran's book. It's recently published, and there's a photograph of the actual page giving the names of the crew. Having been flown back to England as a POW, Terry Finn was then returned to this country in 1945, where he embarked on a new phase in his life as a successful tobacco farmer and father. As one of his sons remarked, you had to be a successful tobacco farmer to put four boys through St. George's. From 1945 to 1980, Terry took Chikanga Farm, which apparently is near Kadoma, from virgin bush to a highly productive farm with some 15 dams or weirs, hundreds of kilometres of maintained roads and fencing, 2 4-bedroom houses and over 50 bricked staff houses, together with more than an acre of roofing over the barns. Then, having survived an ambush at point blank range, apparently 18 bullets came through the back of his cab at the end of the bush war, he went on to beat cancer and to outlive 2 wives. Sadly, the family lost the family farm at the time of the farm invasions at about the same time as he, that Terry, underwent a double knee operation. He died at the age of 87 in June 2004, leaving behind 4 very proud sons and 10 loving grandchildren. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope to have shown how these young boys morphed into very, very brave men. And they were just a few of the hundreds that left here. Those statistics come from a history book. I've just kind of synthesized them down. 6,000, well, you can see these statistics yourself. A surprisingly large number of the soldiers from here went off and then were commissioned in whatever unit they were in. I've gone on far too long. Thank you for your time.
And very, very well researched. I hate to think how long that took you to put all that together, but we thank you for your time and your interest. Are there any questions for John? No questions? Oh, yes.
May I ask about the German Jesuits at St. George's? Did they maintain a correspondence as they did in the First World War, when you mentioned in your first talk?
Interestingly, there was not nearly as much correspondence from boys who went off to the Second World War as there was in the First World War. And by the time that this war started, the last of the German Jesuits had either retired or died. That was, and now the priest, that Father Weaver, the rugby coach, very much an Englishman. So they were English. So there isn't that much correspondence, but the Jesuits, quite a number of the priests at St. George's had been military chaplains in the First World War. And they kept a close eye on what was becoming of the boys. And this is a register that we've got in the college archives, and it lists all of the old Georgians who went off to the First World War and the Second World War, what units they joined, and basically, if they knew the details, what became of them, including awards. And then there's also a list, and there were some 430 odd who went off to sign up. There's also a scrapbook there that they kept. So that cutting, that last one that I showed you, the second last one, that in fact is a cutting from a scrapbook that they kept. And by the way, that date at the bottom there, I don't know where it's come from, he wouldn't have been repatriated in 1944 because they were still behind enemy lines in POW camps.
Any more questions?
As I say, there are people here, hopefully, who have relatives, obviously deceased, but if there are photograph albums out there, don't just throw them away. Very sadly, Paul Nichols' family, not his son Adrian, but his sister, they did have albums that Paul himself had kept while he was a member of 266 Squadron, and at some point when they were downsizing, they were thrown away. So if there are albums, don't throw them away. People would always find them interesting. Thank you.
Right. Can I ask Charles, Tim, can I ask you to please come and formally thank our speaker?
Just before Tim does start, again, just to remind you that on the 10th of November at the Pioneer Cemetery at the Commonwealth War Grave site, there will be a service of commemoration at 10:30. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real treat for me to be able to thank John for that momentous talk. As Robin has said, the work that you've put into that, John, was really, really remarkable. But two thoughts just came to me as the talk was going on. The first is just how very, very proud we must all be of our educational system in this country. The schools to which that you mentioned, all those government schools, Prince Edward Chaplin, Umtali Boys High, and St. George's, it's quite remarkable, I think, that 68% of those people who joined the RAF became officers, and 34% of those who were in the army became commissioned. It's a great, great tribute, I believe, and it's something which I think we can justly be proud of, and which is continuing to this day. We can be very grateful to people like John and others, many of whom are here, who have participated in the educational sphere in this country. And the second thought I had was, with all that's going on in the Middle East at the moment, when we see the virtual hand-to-hand combat, that even in the Air Force, the way that the rockets were put in there, the bombs were dropped, just to think now of the sophistication of weaponry, whereby rockets are sent from hundreds of miles away, pinpointed into an individual target, it's remarkable how things have changed. But nothing can take away from the incredible courage of those young men who, as you correctly say, John, within days of leaving school, were thrown into this morass of fighting and army and bloodshed, and who just matched up in such a remarkable way. John, that was an incredibly good talk. We're so grateful to you, and as was said right at the outset, the fact that you gave that wonderful talk on the First World War, and now we follow on to the Second World War. We are so proud of them, but you really have managed to illustrate it, to highlight just how proud we are of our boys here. But John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just give this to you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you.
All at the luncheon on the 9th of November. Thank you. Go safely.
Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, just one comment for your attention. We need to thank Marco Faccio, our treasurer, for the sound system and all the work that we put into making this possible. Yes.